I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. NPR's treasured host Diane Rehm is at a crossroads. Late this year, after the election, she plans to stop hosting the interview show she has led for nearly four decades. She doesn't say she's retiring because she intends to stay active in many ways, especially advocating for state legislation to allow doctors to prescribe life-ending medication to mentally competent adults who are terminally ill. In her just-published memoir, On My Own, Diane Rehm describes watching her husband starve himself to death after deciding that Parkinson's had left him no reason to live. She writes about her first year as a widow and how it is reshaping her identity. Diane Rehm joins us to discuss On My Own on Midday after the news from NPR. Hey, welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you're with us today for what I know will be a memorable conversation. Public Radio's beloved host, Diane Rehm, is joining us to discuss her just-published memoir titled On My Own. That label memoir may not fully convey how intense this slender volume is, how very candid Diane is in describing the death of her husband at 54 years, John Rehm. Her rage that Maryland law didn't give him the option of assisted suicide. Her experience as a widow, experience of grief that rolls over her in waves, and how she sees her life going forward. A lot to talk about in this hour, and I am thrilled to welcome Diane Rehm here to Midday. We're reaching her at her home in Washington. Diane Rehm, thanks so much for joining us.
Sheila, I'm delighted to be with you.
And we are delighted to have you. All the reflections that make up this memoir start with your husband John's decision after living with Parkinson's disease for 9 years that he wanted his life to be over. Walk us through that.
Well, it was for him a decision that probably was not made just at the last minute. It was something he and I had talked about over the years. The idea that when the time came, if one of us were incapacitated, if one of us felt as though we could no longer contribute to society, we did not wish to go into an assisted living facility. In fact, Sheila, I'm surprised that in the end, John agreed to do so. But he did. He was there for a year and a half. And finally, when he no longer had use of his hands, he could no longer feed himself, he could no longer walk, he could barely move within his bed, he said, "I am ready to die."
Were you expecting him to make that decision?
I really had a sense that the time was coming, as his abilities were diminishing. I think had he been able to stay here in our apartment, had he been able to enjoy life, I mean, even the simplest things like going out for a walk, like being with friends, having a supper together, even sitting at table with me, I think he would not have made the decision he did, but he felt the time had come to relinquish life. You used the phrase assisted suicide. That is truly not what I think of it as. I think of it as his hoping that he would have aid in dying, which is a very, very different concept, one where a doctor provides the necessary or adequate medication, and then that individual decides on his or her own when the time has come. No doctor is present. No one is assisting that individual. In fact, in Oregon, where that first law was passed, aid in dying, the law requires that no doctor be present, but that simply a doctor provides the medication. And in Oregon, perhaps two-thirds of those who've been provided with a medication have taken it. One-third have said, now I feel comfortable. I have the power in my hands. But they've not used it.
And you used the verb a minute ago that you think what John was hoping was the situation you describe of aid in dying. What actually happened?
Well, what actually happened after John and I had a conversation with his doctor, with our son David present in the room, and our daughter Jenny, who is a physician herself, on the line from Boston. What happened was John Rehm said to the doctor, I am ready to die. And the doctor said, you know, I'm so sorry. I cannot morally, ethically, or legally help you in any way to die. The only way you can actively end your life is to stop eating, stop drinking, stop taking medication. And John said, well, I'll think about that. And overnight, he decided that that was precisely what he was going to do.
And how did you react to that decision? You've described to us that the overall issue, the topic, was something that you and John had spoken about for years, long before he was ill. But when he actually said, I've come to this decision,
Sheila,
how did that strike you?
I was so sad. I was so sad. I mean, this is my beloved husband of 54 years. I mean, no matter how sick he was, he's still my love. Mm-hmm. So the idea of his relinquishing life made me so sad for him and selfishly for myself, knowing that I would no longer be able to pick up the phone and call him or leave work and go right over to Brighton Gardens to see him. You know, it's a hard decision. And I said to him, sweetheart, are you sure this is what you want? Absolutely, he said. I am ready for the next journey.
That's Diane Rehm here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. What would you like to ask Diane Rehm about her memoir, On My Own, about her advocacy for aid in dying? Send us an email at midday@wipr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. Diane, tell us about John.
John Rehm, when I first met him, was an attorney at the State Department dealing with foreign trade issues. He was about 6 feet tall and looked like a football player. He had huge shoulders because he had worked in his father's rock quarry on his father's farm during the summers while he was going to college and even law school. And he just, you know, he was so strong. He was so brilliant. He was the youngest attorney ever appointed to be an assistant legal advisor for economic affairs at the Department of State. I happened to be a secretary working on the foreign trade issues with my boss, and John was working with him. That's how we met. He was brilliant. He was, in so many ways, a Renaissance man. He loved art. He loved music. He loved literature. And he knew so much. There was no question I could ask him that he couldn't at least try to help me understand. And that was the wonder of John Rehm.
I got the impression from various reminiscences in on my own that he was pretty much a loner, that he preferred solitude to the company of others, even though he could be quite charming.
He often said that he preferred to have lunch with the New Yorker magazine than any other human being he knew. And I certainly knew that that included me. But dinner was really fine. I don't eat lunch in any event, so that was just fine. But he was, Sheila, a loner. He probably, if he had had his druthers, would never have become a lawyer. He probably, because he was a Greek and Latin scholar in college, he probably would have gone on to teaching had he not needed to earn a better living in order to pay back any debts he incurred. He had gone to Friends Seminary on scholarship. He had gone to Harvard on scholarship and finally went to Columbia Law School, which he did not enjoy very much. But in the end, he did help to establish the office of the U.S. Special Trade Representative and became the first general counsel to the director, who was Governor Christian Herter, who had been previously Secretary of State.
As you write, it took about 10 days from when John Rehm decided to stop taking any nourishment or liquids or medications until he passed away. That must have been really hard.
It was hard. The morning I got there when he had made his decision, he said, "You know, I feel quite well. I haven't had any water, I've had no food, I've had no medication, and I feel quite well." And I had brought with me that day a photograph album I had made for him of his, from his childhood leading up to his graduation from Harvard, and I sat on the bed with him. We looked at the photographs together. He loved doing that. And he was really fine that Saturday and Sunday. And by Monday, when I had gotten there after work, he had begun the glide. And
the
he fell asleep, and he never woke up again.
Diane Rehm, you know the clock of this hour better than I do. You know we need to take a short break here. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Diane Rehm about her memoir of widowhood and rebuilding her life. We'll talk about her decision to, as she says, step away from the microphone at the end of this year. And we'll take your calls, 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. On the line with us from her home in Washington is Diane Rehm, whose syndicated interview show is heard on nearly 200 public radio stations, including WIPR. About 2.5 million people listen each week. Diane, you take us into your memoir, On My Own. You really take us into your journey into widowhood. And I must say, sometimes you are so candid, so intimate, that I felt like I had blundered into something I should not be reading. I think the moment that was most vivid to me came 2 weeks after John died, when for the first time since you were married, you moved to the center of the bed. If you have a copy of the book near you, could you read those first two paragraphs on page 48?
I do, Sheila, and I'd be glad to. The chapter is titled Our Bed. Last night, for the very first time since I was married, I moved to the center of our bed. It's a queen-size four-poster, the bed John and I shared for many years, beginning when we first moved to our second home on Worthington Drive in Bethesda, Maryland. Up until now, and for all the years that John and I slept in separate rooms and then in separate residences, I've slept on my side of the bed. I couldn't manage to bring myself to sleep anywhere else. His side was his, with a pillow there for him. There was an emptiness, of course, on his side of the bed, but it never occurred to me to shift and assume possession of the entire bed. Always, his presence was there in my mind, head on pillow, turned either toward or away from me. But last night, 9 days after his memorial service, I hesitantly decided to move my pillows to the center. I knew I'd feel awkward, but I wanted to try. I spent the entire night wide awake, unable to shake the finality of the shift and what it represented.
And, of course, in that chapter you go on to write about the bed being such an important place of communication. And that's another area in which you are, to me, astonishingly candid in sharing not just your widowhood, but parts of your marriage. You write about John confessing to you, I guess this was several days before his decision to stop eating and drinking, but he confessed to you that there had been times in your marriage when he deliberately, when his behavior was deliberately emotionally abusive. And you said you were shocked by that, too.
I was shocked by the confession. I wasn't shocked to know that that's what he had done. I felt as though there were periods in our marriage when he literally stepped away from it, when he shut me out, when he would not speak. If we had had an exchange of words about something, a disagreement about something, and he did not like what I had said, he would not speak with me for weeks at a time. And you know, Sheila, it's interesting because my mother was the same way. So that, in effect, I had, through my marriage, had repeated almost the same behavior of childhood. And if I had had more wisdom, if I had been a more mature person in my own thinking, what I would have done, could have done, should have done, was simply to walk away and not continue to pursue him, to say, please tell me what's wrong. You know, why can't we work this out? And if I had simply walked away, as I finally was able to do, I think our marriage would have been a lot smoother.
So you're not talking about walking away from the marriage.
No,
you're talking
of
about
course
walking away,
not.
Walking away from the argument or from
exactly,
the
exactly, or walking away from the rejection, stepping back and being unto myself as he was unto himself. I think we both would have been a lot better off.
I think some people in reading, as I said, this extraordinarily candid discussion will be a little confused about how that behavior still, how your relationship could be still so strong and such a force in your life that it is such a great grief to have lost him.
Oh, Sheila, there are no perfect marriages in this world. Let's face it, there are some really good ones, but they're not without difficulty. And ours was clearly one that perhaps was not made to be, but we deeply loved each other. Our personalities were so different. Our needs were so different. We approached child raising in such different ways. But I knew at our base we had a strong love for each other. There were so many happy times. There were so many beautiful times between us. But there was also that basic difficulty of his needing more distance than I. Two very, very different personalities who connected at wonderful times and had great distance at many other times.
You know that voice. That's Diane Rehm, but this is not the show you're used to hearing her on. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Diane Rehm's memoir, On My Own. You can be part of the conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Daniel from Baltimore has called us. Daniel, welcome to Midday.
Oh, hi, Sheila. Diane?
Hi, Daniel.
Diane, I had read a book by Eleanor Roosevelt, which was entitled On My Own, and I just was wondering whether there was any connection that you had similar to the life of Eleanor Roosevelt, as you would see if there was any anything that you may have had in common.
Well, I must say, I always have been a great admirer of Eleanor Roosevelt. I have not read that book, and I did not know I was taking the same title as her book. Now that you pointed that out, I must go back and read that book. Perhaps, I mean, I know that FDR certainly had his own life, and of course, after he died, Eleanor Roosevelt did create her own ongoing involvement in life. I would not be so bold as to compare myself to that great lady, but I do think
that... I'll say it. I can see some parallels. Daniel, I appreciate the call, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
Diane, I wish we were together so you could see my marked-up copy of On My Own. In the first essays, every time you write about what solace you find in your work on The Diane Rehm Show, how it kept you tethered and functioning after John's death. I'm scribbling in the margin. Then why are you retiring? I've got all these marginal notes. And then as your essays proceed, I start to understand it better. But like most of your fans, I am finding it hard to adjust to the news that you intend to leave your show late this year. So walk us through your thinking.
All right. My thinking is not the word retirement. I do not plan to retire. I plan to step away from the microphone. Sheila, very bluntly, I am 79 years old. By the time I step away from the microphone, I will be 80. I have had this wonderful program for 37 years. I will have by then, and feel as though it's time for someone else to have this opportunity to speak across the country, to bring new ideas, to bring new thoughts, to galvanize perhaps even a broader listenership with fresh thoughts, fresh ideas. You know, I think when you do something for as long as I have, though I must say the program has changed and grown a great deal over the years, it does seem to me that it's important to make sure that someone else gets a chance to move in. Now, what I intend to do is to stay with WAMU, which has been my home station, just as WYPR is yours. It's been my home station since 1973. I'm going to stay there to do what I can to bring in more listeners, to bring in more donors, to bring in more attention to the station by virtue, say, of doing public events at the museum where I bring in individuals who would draw an audience, say, who would want to be present for a live interview of that sort. In addition, I will also be doing what I can for Parkinson's disease. I will also continue my acting role for Alzheimer's in a play titled Surviving Grace.
Yeah, tell us about that. I did not know you were you got involved in a theatrical production in your first year of widowhood.
Indeed, and the play was written by Trish Bradenburg. It appeared initially off-Broadway, and now, after it appeared here in Washington, and when I say appeared, what we are doing is reading the first act so that people are on stage at podiums at and reading, so I do not have to memorize, and nor does any other part of the cast. But we are performing this first act about a woman who, in her mid-50s, begins to fall into Alzheimer's, and I play that woman.
Mm.
And in the play, I mean, it really tracks the reality of what happened with Trish Bradenburg's mother, in that her father divorced their mother and married a much younger woman. while her mother was in an institution. So it is a very moving play. We performed it here in Washington, out in Los Angeles, in Indianapolis, in North Carolina. We had a huge dinner at the governor's mansion. It's been a lot of fun. I'm going to be doing that and speaking out across the country about the right to die, which I so strongly believe in, for myself, and believe that each person should have the right to choose rather than to be compelled to continue medication, to continue to live, if I feel that my life is no longer what I want it to be. I want to be able to obtain aid in dying.
And of course, that is a point of debate for many people, a point of strongly held views, views held as strongly as you hold yours on the other side. We talked earlier about the language. You said you, for example, don't consider John's act an act of suicide, but an act of relinquishment. The language that legislation will be discussed in the Maryland legislature this year is the End of Life Option Act. Its chief sponsor is Democratic Delegate Shane Pendergrass of Howard County. A similar bill failed to get a vote last year in the General Assembly. When you say you're going to speak out, do you intend to lobby a state legislature like Maryland?
I'm not sure lobby is the right word. I will be speaking around the country about my own beliefs. In other words, as you accurately say, there are many people who hold different beliefs that they want to continue with palliative care as long as possible. And doctors who wish to be able to provide palliative care feel so strongly that they can alleviate a patient's desire to die. And I think that that needs to be honored as well. What I am saying is that for myself and for those other people who choose to have aid in dying, that they should have that right, just as others choose to continue palliative care.
Diane Rehm, as you know, we need to take another short break here. Diane Rehm is with us the rest of the hour. There's lots more to talk to her about, including more questions from you. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking to Diane Rehm about her new memoir, On My Own. And we're taking your calls. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. midday@wypr.org is our email. We got a message from Nathan, headlined Gratitude for Diane Rehm. He writes, oh, I'm sorry, it's not Nathan, it's Naomi. Excuse my bad eyesight. Naomi writes, as a relatively conservative but nonetheless diehard NPR fan, I wonder if Diane Rehm had one thing to say to the conservative listeners of NPR, what would it be? And what can we do to try to continue her legacy of respectful but challenging discussion?
I think the one thing I would say is, I'm so glad you're listening. I'm so happy that you identify yourself as a conservative. You are, in my mind, broad-minded because you are listening to public radio, which I believe and have always believed brings you the full picture, the fullest while we're at it, let me just give a shout-out to Nathan Sterner. I do so love him. And he was, of course, at WAMU before he left us for WYPR.
Yes, and WYPR is grateful for the training that you gave him.
He is wonderful.
He certainly is. We're going to continue this love fest now. I think we're going to talk to Anne, who is calling us. Anne, welcome to Midday.
Hello?
Hello, Anne. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi, I just want to thank you, Diane, because since 1973, I've listened to you. In those days, I was a potter. Our youngest child was 3, and our lives have so many parallels. And I have never called you. I've listened almost on a daily basis and worked in hospice for 7 years, and I so agree with what you're trying to do. You are a wonderful person. You have given an unbelievable amount, and I just wanted to use this opportunity to thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you very, very much. You know, John Rehm was a hospice volunteer after he retired from his practice at law. He trained for 1 year to be a docent at the Freer and Sackler Galleries. He became a reader for the blind and dyslexic, and he became a volunteer for hospice. So he had planned that retirement for a good number of years before he stepped away from the law, and he had such a wonderful time during those 5 years after he retired and before Parkinson's took away his ability to continue with his good services.
Diane, I'm wondering whether you think that being a host for so long has helped you learn to read people.
I think it has helped me learn to listen better, Sheila. And listening is key if you want to try to understand someone else's perspective, if you want to know someone else. And I think that listening as carefully as you and I must do when someone is on the air with us, you do learn to understand people better, where they're coming from and how they want to come across. But, and this is the one disadvantage today, quite frequently when I have someone on the phone, I try to do it via Skype because in addition to listening, I love having people that I can see. I love watching their body movements. I want to see their facial expressions. I want to see whether they're smiling, whether they're frowning. So all of that goes into acute listening.
You listened quite carefully to quite a few friends while you were writing the essays that make up On My Own, and some of them are people we know, like Susan Stamberg and Eleanor Clift, who both talked to you about how they dealt with bereavement.
And both of them said that work was key. Both, in effect, said they ran away as fast as they could from grief by turning to work, by accepting as many invitations as they could, by being with friends as much as possible, but that work itself became the key to help them somehow move away from the idea of dwelling on grief. But Sheila, it's not that easy. I mean, I could be in the middle of a conversation on the air and somehow thoughts thoughts of John would creep into my mind and into my heart. It wasn't easy, certainly in that first year, but work is what keeps us strong and what keeps us going, and that's certainly what Susan and Eleanor experienced.
It's been about a year and a half. Is it any easier?
You know, people ask whether there is something like closure, and I have to say it's not a word I either like or believe in. I think John will be with me for the rest of my days. I talk with him every single day. I talk with Maxie, my little dog, as though I were talking with John. He's in my heart. He'll be in my heart forever. When I'm at the studio and I'm recording promos or billboards, and then waiting to hear how they sound, I'm looking out the window at the clouds and talking to John. And he talks back to me. I know that sounds weird, but it's true, and I'm very grateful that it happens. Closure is not something I'm looking for. In fact, having John with me makes me feel better.
In what way do you feel him talking back to you or hear him talking back to you?
When I say I'm worried about something or I'm overstressed or I'm overtired, I can hear him saying, "Sweetheart, you know, you've got to slow down. You've got to take it easy. Remember that this too shall pass. You'll get beyond this. You always have." Whatever the stress is, hearing that voice in my head really calms me down and helps me.
That's Diane Rehm here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her just-published memoir, On My Own. Mike is calling us from Severn, Maryland. Mike, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Diane, an honor. I've been listening to you for so many years. I just wanted to say one thing that I love about the way you speak with your guests is you never hesitate to challenge them on facts. And it doesn't matter what station in life they come from. If there's something in the logic that's flawed or doesn't make sense, you'll call them out. I remember one instance with Lynn Cheney that got a little heated, and I was like, wow. You just don't hear that kind of pushback from so many talk show folks, and I really appreciate your coverage.
Thank you so much. It's important because I know that if you were sitting in my chair and someone said something that didn't make sense to you, of course you'd ask. If you were sitting in a restaurant and just talking with that person and that person didn't make or made a statement that did not sound quite right to you, of course you'd say, well, I don't get that. Can you explain further? Or, you know, I'm not sure that that's the way the facts really rolled out. And Sheila, I'm sure you do the same thing. It's so important to understand that you and I stand in for the mics of this world, the people who are out there listening, wanting to know the truth and the facts. And you and I have to be their representatives, as I know you are, and I have tried to be.
Florence has a question about what your new role will be. Florence, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello, Florence. You're on the air.
Yes. First, I want to thank Diane for many wonderful experiences that I've had with her on the radio. I was wondering if I wish that she would have some kind of arrangement, you, Diane, with NPR, that if once in a while you feel like coming back and doing a show, something you particularly want to share or something special, or you just feel like doing a program once in a while, that you might come back and do that.
You know, Florence, I really have not yet mapped out fully how these next years are going to go. None of us can really know what the future holds, but I think your idea is not out of the question. And we shall see. We shall see whether WAMU or NPR want such a program. You never know. Thank you for the suggestion.
Thank you for the call, Florence. You talked, Diane, about getting fresh ideas on the air, giving someone else a voice. Are there voices that you think NPR should be doing more to encourage?
Well, certainly I think NPR, WAMU stations around the country are certainly trying to encourage more, a greater variety of ethnic and racial backgrounds onto the air. And certainly that's what we're looking at and thinking about, and I'm sure this too will come to pass. You know as well as I do that listenership to public radio among minorities is quite low, and what we'd like to see happen is to encourage not only listenership but greater on-air participation, and I do think that will come about.
Diane, as you know, we need to bring this conversation to a close. The hour is wrapping up, and I really want to thank you on behalf of the listeners. I want to thank you for this hour and for this book and for all the insight you have brought to public radio for so long. Thank you very, very much.
Sheila, thank you for the invitation. I was delighted to be with you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay.
And
bye
also
bye.
Thanks to our listeners. And I want to thank also the DIS for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The DIS is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The DIS is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on weekends on the web at thedisbaltimore.com. I'm Sheila Cass. Tomorrow we're going to look at how different Baltimore City Council will be after this year's election. But now, stay tuned for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.